You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Serious talk about the sacred book. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Bible for Normal People. Just a quick reminder that we are, at this point, shamelessly plugging our new old book, the second edition of Genesis for Normal People, which is out now. You can buy it on Amazon, anywhere fine books are sold online, or go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/books, and you'll find a link there. So just a reminder, that's out now. We're really excited about it. We hope you can pick up a copy. Today, our topic is, does the New Testament predict the future? So, Well, does it, Pete? Does it?
They're going to have to listen to this podcast. And the answer is yes and no.
Of course.
Typical.
It depends.
It depends.
That's what the Bible is all about. It depends.
This is how scholars obfuscate simple things, obvious things.
That's right. So today we are talking with Andrew Perryman, who's a New Testament scholar who focuses on the New Testament and has written pretty extensively on this understanding of things like apocalyptic, eschatological revelation, Jesus talking about the future, and we want to maybe spend a few minutes here. Why don't we unpack some of that? Because that's some big terminology that we use there.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, what I think should come through is that talking about the New Testament and what the New Testament says about the future is actually a little bit complicated. It's not obvious. But, you know, Andrew uses some terms because, you know, he's a New Testament scholar, and a few of those we just want to throw out there and just briefly define them. And, you know, if you're not familiar with them, you can look them up too. But he mentions a guy, Josephus, who was a first century Jewish interpreter of the times. And, you know, he might make an occasional reference to Christianity. That's a little bit debated, at least some of those are. But he's a Jewish interpreter trying to sort of explain Jewish history to the elite of the day. And he's an important sort of witness to what's happening in Judaism during the first century. That's that. He mentions this term parousia or parousia, which is a Greek term, which means sort of like
coming.
Arriving.
You know?
Yeah, the coming of Jesus, which is sort of a technical term that just means second coming. Or just any coming.
Coming,
not,
yeah.
Not the first, not, see, that's the point. You got to listen to this, right? Because I right away went to that default place. And that's sort of like what Andrew's saying. You can't go there because the New Testament might not be talking about stuff the way we're used to hearing it. He also mentions Antiochus Epiphanes, which is a great name if you're a homeschooler to name your kids. It's sort of a biblical name, but not really. But he was a, you know, long story short, he was a Greek ruler who lived in the early second century BC. And it was under his rule that there was a lot of attempts to force Jews to convert to Jewish ways. And that's important because that sets a big tone for what it means to be Jewish in that world and how that really that narrative continued into the time of Jesus. You know, when we think of how Jesus and Paul relate to their own tradition, we tend to jump right to the Old Testament. But we have to be careful because in that immediate background is the issue of Jewish identity in the face of Greek persecution. And now the Romans are in charge. And how are things going
to
go?
Well, there's like 400. Yeah, it's interesting. You have to think about it in context that there is at least a few hundred years between what we would call the Old Testament and the New Testament. Daniel, of course, which we reference in here, is pretty late. Mm-hmm. So you know, I grew up thinking that was an older book, but it would be kind of in the same place that Antiochus Epiphanes would be around. Mm-hmm. And it's just important because we want to say, what's the context of the New Testament? What's the Old Testament? Well,
not
there's
really
these few hundred years. That's a long time.
It's the Old Testament as it's been creatively handled by Jews living for centuries by the time we get to Jesus and Paul. And they're part of that story. They're part of that tradition.
Yeah.
And part of that too, he mentions also, Andrew mentions Maccabean literature. Well, if you look in the Apocrypha, oh gosh, which is part of—
You're just digging yourself a
hole.
I know.
Sorry,
more
folks.
More.
You can't talk about anything without talking about everything.
During this time period, there were books written that we often call the Apocrypha, which is kind of a not nice way of saying it because that means fake or false.
Well, it means hidden, but they're not really hidden because everybody's reading them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're called hidden because they're part of the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox canon, authoritative books, but not for Protestants. But there's great stuff in there. And the Maccabean literature has to do with this time period of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Mm-hmm. And so he mentions a story of martyrs that's mentioned in 2 Maccabees chapter 7.
Impress and we would pastor. Just recommend reading some of these books because it's good for your to know your Jewish neighbors too, because this is where we get the story of Hanukkah.
Right, exactly.
So if you wanted to know about what Hanukkah is about, read 1, 2, 3, and 4 Maccabees and you'll get a good picture of that.
Right, right. And don't stab your eyes out as you're doing it because it's sort of long. But I mean, actually, Jared and I were talking before. We love that stuff. It's like it's a window into the world that was more immediately relevant for the New Testament than Hosea or Isaiah, right? It's all those things had already been handled, interpreted, and I like the word reimagined and thought about differently because of different circumstances. But anyway, those are just some of the terms, I guess, you know, that he uses. And, you know, I think it's good to be exposed to some of the – for those of you – for this is new. This might be new for some of you. It's good to be exposed to that kind of vocabulary, not to impress people, but – it's sort of shorthand ways of referring to some very important things that people talk about a lot when it comes to these kinds of topics like Jesus and Paul. And
not normal people, but some people like Andrew.
See, here's our real goal is to turn all you normal people into abnormal people.
Don't give away our secret.
Oh, no. We were going to announce that next month. Oh, well, I screwed up. So.
That's right. Excellent. All right. Well, let's get this conversation with Andrew.
Essentially, the church forgot the story that had sort of given rise to it. Everything that had sort of been given to the church in narrative form was felt to have come to some sort of climax and conclusion in Jesus, and then it gets translated into theological concepts. The church forgot what the point of it was. So we have inherited what seems to me a rather empty doctrine. We've lost the interpretive narrative.
Let's talk microdosing, as you'd expect from a Bible podcast. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good.
And you know, microdose gummies are good for so many things like anxiety, workflow, sleeping, and stuff like that. I mean, Jared, we've had people in our lives that have benefited from this too, not just us.
Yeah, I have a family member who regularly uses microdosing for more creative, like recreational time. At times they journal every night and it's sort of a way to unwind and do the journaling. And that's worked really well for them.
Our producer. It's made such a difference, folks. I can't even tell you that. So anyway, and for me as well, microdose gummies helped me a lot with anxiety and sleep and just stopping that racing mind at night. And it helps tremendously. I get a good night's sleep. So get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com. Promo code normal people. It's available nationwide.
That's microdose.com, promo code normal people for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code normal people.
Right, Andrew, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. Finally, I've been reading you for years and now you're finally here. So,
Andrew, what we like to start just by, I think we have a lot of fascinating things to talk about today, and I'm really interested to dive in. But before we do that, maybe give a little taste of your background. And you do a lot with the Bible. You have a lot of things, interesting insights into the Bible. But how did you first get started with that? What's some of your background?
I mean, I guess the thing to go back to is university. And what I did at university was an English literature degree. And I think, in one way or another, that sort of set the tone, it set the direction for the approach to scripture. So I've not come into this particularly from the point of someone trained to be, as a pastor or as a theologian. The initial interest in it was much more as a work of literature, I guess. But I sort of fairly soon after university, I went to what was London Bible College then, spent some time there, and then went on to do some postgraduate work and an MPhil and a PhD. But we were traveling around the world. My wife's work in the oil and gas industry was sort of taking us to various parts of the world. So I was doing much of this work on my own. Writing was something I could do under those conditions, and I spent a lot of time reading, researching, and putting my thoughts down.
You have an interest in, well, what I called earlier, I mistakenly, before the podcast, was talking about the second coming of Jesus. And because in my background, that would have been a big event. We're always looking for signs that Jesus is coming back.
Yeah.
And you challenged me on that and said maybe that's not a really biblical way of even looking at that. So maybe can you say more about that as we talk about this idea of end times or Jesus coming back or the coming of the Son of Man or apocalyptic? Oh, there's many ways to look at that. So how do you frame that?
Well, It's a question of perspective. So yes, I mean, we can look at the future from our point of view, and we're given a large amount of material in the New Testament, and perhaps you want to include the Old Testament as well. And you think, well, look, if this sort of massive dramatic thing has not yet happened, then it's still in the future. And okay, that sort of gives us the opportunity to speculate as to how these things might play out in some remote future. That's looking at it from our perspective. My concern has always been to ask, well, how does this language sound from the perspective of the historical community at the time of writing, the time of first reception? And then you begin to sort of ask, well, where has the language come from? How was it used in its original context? What are the conditions? What are the circumstances? What are the, you know, what are they looking at in terms of the world that they live in? Things that might be down the road from their point of view, and how are they using the material that they've drawn pretty much mostly from the Old Testament? How are they using that to define the future as they might have seen it from their point of view? And clearly, you know, from that point of view, there's an image in there at the heart of that that is of Jesus coming with the clouds of heaven. Jesus talks about it, and then in sort of slightly less precise ways, we find it elsewhere in the New Testament. But it's central in some fashion to how Jesus and the early church saw their future. The question is, you know, once you put yourself within the confines of that historical perspective, how is that language, how would you imagine that language to be applied? What are the boundaries to it? How far ahead are we looking? What going on in the real world might that, what sort of issues, what sort of developments going on in the real world might that language have applied to? And you know, you then end up with potentially a foreshortened perspective. How, you know, this question, how far are they looking? And we can sort of ask the question of ourselves, if we look into the future, what are we realistically looking at? What lies down the road for us? I mean, I'm in the UK. One of the things that potentially lies down the road is Brexit. So this sort of new relationship with Europe. What might one want to say about that? Not from a sort of Christian biblical point of view, but just in terms of understanding our world. Much further down the road, or maybe not that much further down the road, are issues relating to climate change. How do we talk about those within sort of the normal secular context, but perhaps also increasingly from a sort of Christian point of view?
So, Andrew, just I'm going to make sure I understand here. So what you're saying, this is very interesting here. I think what you're saying is how we today talk about the future of Brexit and the future of climate change, we might need to think of Jesus's second coming, if that's even the right way to put it, the same way, like from the perspective of those who were uttering that way back when. What were they thinking, and what might the, what are they expecting using language like that? And it might not be how that language has come to be understood over, let's say, the centuries.
Yeah, I mean, a lot has happened. That was a long time ago. And obviously, one of the things that happened was that the church moved into the Greek and Roman world, into a very different culture, a very different worldview, where language functioned very differently, where there are different philosophical presuppositions that are brought to. And I think critically, I think essentially the church forgot the story that had sort of given rise to it. So everything that has sort of been given to the church in narrative form as, you know, an engagement of God's people with historical crises, you know, lurching from one crisis to another and trying to make sense of it as God's people, that long story was felt to have come to some sort of climax and conclusion in Jesus, and then it gets translated into basically sort of theological concepts. And we've inherited that, and one of those ideas, one of those concepts has been the second coming, because clearly that's there in the New Testament. But my sense is the church fairly quickly forgot what the point of it was. So we have inherited what seems to me a rather empty doctrine. There's a point to it. You can say, well, Jesus coming on the clouds of heaven to sort of wrap up history, something like that. But we've lost the interpretive narrative that made sense of it to the early church. And we're simply no longer in the historical situation where it was felt to be important to be able to say these things, for Jesus to communicate to his disciples, for Paul to sort of teach the churches, for John in Revelation to sort of do whatever he's doing in Revelation. That needed to be said at that point. Well, you know, do we need to say it in the same terms now, or have we sort of moved into a very sort of different future where things look very different, and that sort of language simply doesn't work the same way?
Right. Okay, well, let's get into some specifics in a minute, but the Greek and Roman, let's say, categories that maybe usurped the Jewish narrative, I think, is what you're saying. About when are we talking about? Is this second century? Is this later than that? Or roughly when are we talking?
Well, I mean, sort of. I'm not an early church historian. I'm not going to try and sort of give a detailed account. Clearly, what preoccupied the early church from a fairly early on was not eschatology, it was Christology, and you know, how do we talk about who Jesus is and who Jesus is in relation to the Father and to the Spirit and so on. So, you know, for some time, that was what preoccupied the minds of the early church, the early church fathers. And I mean, eschatology is there, and there's the odd sort of millenarian movement, isn't there? Mm-hmm. But it's already become a fringe thing. It's become a sort of a distraction. It's become disruptive. So you get the sense that the church is having to sort of consolidate and develop a new worldview that works in the Greek and Roman environment. And eschatology was threatening, perhaps for very good reason. So my guess is it largely gets suppressed. And it's probably only in the modern era that it's sort of gone somewhat mainstream again. And now we're sort of coming back to it with a very different set of questions because of what we've learned from historical criticism and so on.
So you say that eschatology may have been suppressed in a way that because it would have been threatening. Why would it have been threatening in that day?
This is beyond my my knowledge, somewhat my area of knowledge. Eschatology. I mean, apocalyptic is shaking up. It threatens systems. So there's an essential message there that everything is going to be thrown into disorder. God is going to do something new and overturn the present arrangement. And if the present arrangement is the church trying to sort of build, you know, whatever it's trying to do in those centuries, then apocalyptic is going to be disruptive.
So would those, so to get really concrete, those passages in the New Testament, Revelation, or even some of these passages we have in the Gospels that point to the future, you know, what I heard you saying earlier was what they might have meant in that context wasn't to sort of propel us 2,000 years into the future for us to think about it in the same way, but they had a very specific context that it wasn't just out of blue that they were in some sort of trance and see some sort of future vision, but it's almost like they're reading the signs of the times. There are cracks in the foundations. Yeah. There are things going on at that time that led to a more imminent conclusion than maybe what I would have grown up thinking about. So what was that context? What were the cracks in the foundations? And was there a culmination point in the ancient world that we could point to and say, this is probably what was being talked about rather than 2,000 years ago and, you know, all these political things that are happening today?
Yeah, I sort of talk in terms of three horizons, three eschatological horizons that we find in the New Testament. And the first one is from Jesus' point of view, from the point of view of the early church in Jerusalem. The horizon is what is going to happen to Jerusalem, what is going to happen to the temple, what is going to happen to that whole system that up until that point had sustained a people as a witness to the living God. And I mean, that's a fairly clear horizon. The war against Rome, which was not that difficult to predict, was that sort of massive turning point, that massive disruption of the whole thing, and the moment when, you know, from our point of view, looking back as sort of heirs of the New Testament, that is the moment that really concretely marked the transition from Second Temple Judaism to the Church of Jesus Christ as that sort of witnessing community. That, I think, is the first horizon. I think Jesus, pretty much everything that Jesus says is said with that horizon in view. And, you know, so one of the implications of this approach is that actually we're putting more than just certain eschatological passages back into that framework. We're putting the whole thing back into that framework and not trying to sort of tease these different bits apart. This belongs there and this we can work with now and so on. Initially, at least, it's sort of treated as a whole narrative, as whole cloth, and ask how does it speak to us from within its own context with that horizon fairly sort of clearly, fairly firmly in view. The second horizon, I think, doesn't sort of begin to emerge until the church gets out into the Greek and Roman world, and then the fate of Israel doesn't get forgotten. But clearly then new challenges arise, new opportunities arise, and I think at that point the issue becomes, well, is if Jesus has been seated at the right hand of God as Israel's king, what does that mean for the nations? And specifically, I think, I think the New Testament is fairly focused still, what does that mean for the nations of the Greek and Roman world? So the prospect emerges that you know God has made his son king, put him, this is a sort of descendant of David, has been seated at the right hand of power, given all authority and power. It suddenly dawns on them that this is going to change not just Israel's world, it's going to change the Greek and Roman world. And I would go as far as to say that when Paul in Philippians 2 speaks of every knee bowing, every tongue confessing that Jesus Christ is Lord, he means, in practice, in effect, the nations of the empire. And so that, which sort of allows us then to sort of bring Christendom and the whole of Christian Europe and the history that ensued from that, everything that happened as a consequence, for better or for worse, it at least allows us to join up the story. So the biblical narrative, the Old Testament narrative, New Testament narrative, story of the church, they link together, they join together. So that would be a second horizon, and I think
before you get to the third, Andrew, I just want to be clear. The first horizon, the first horizon is Jesus,
AD 70, the war against Rome, and the destruction of Jerusalem.
And the second horizon, we're still in the New Testament, right?
Yes,
okay.
I think so.
You mentioned Philippians and things, so right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, this is sort of less, this less clear cut. It's harder to argue, and in a sense that that second horizon is a bit further off. It's not so sharply conceived. It's sort of somewhat hazier. It's in the cloud, but I think it, this expectation arises that the God of Israel, not only puts his people right, he then deals with the enemies of his people. He then deals with that hostile context that is sort of, the nations conspiring against the Lord and his anointed. Mm-hmm. God deals with that.
Okay.
He does, certainly in Old Testament terms, you would expect that. And a big part of the argument is that actually the New Testament is simply a continuation of that Old Testament story with similar constraints on it from that historical point of view. So, yes, I would say, and I accept the fact that this is controversial, and I don't get a lot of agreement on this from people. But I think to understand the next stage of New Testament eschatology, we have to be willing to take very seriously that sort of historical moment of the conversion of the Roman Empire.
Okay. All right.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever.
I was worried about talking about fast-growing trees on here because I'm not a green thumb. But then I realized that probably makes me the perfect candidate to be able to talk about this. I loved the website. It was so easy. It was searchable by region. And then the experts who are there to help you make the decisions lowers the anxiety around something I don't typically know a lot about, but it was a really good experience.
This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on selected plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code NORMALPEOPLE at checkout.
That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code NORMALPEOPLE at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code NORMALPEOPLE. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit a million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.
So, I don't get a lot of agreement on that. Interestingly, with biblical scholars, it's hard to argue with historians. The penny drops. Often they're ahead of me, and I find sort of chatting to historians about this that it's sort of not such a remarkable claim to be making, right? that one of a major trajectory of New Testament eschatology lands with the conversion of the nations, and that moment when the nations of their world confess that Jesus Christ is Lord.
So this is Constantine in the 4th century, and...
Yeah.
Right? So is that the third horizon, or are we still on the
second? No, that's the second horizon.
Okay, the third horizon then.
So the third horizon, I don't think you see very... it doesn't sort of feature very prominently in the New Testament, but I think it's very clear, certainly at the end of Revelation, and there are pointers to it here and there in Paul, and that is the renewal of heaven and earth, some sort of some final act of putting things right on the part of the Creator God, a final judgment, a final destruction of all that is evil, and a renewal of heaven and earth, because it's intolerable that the Creator would indefinitely put up with a marred creation. Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense in which it seems to kind of be scaling out in some ways. This first horizon, Jesus is interested in the question of what's going to happen to Jerusalem in the future. And the gospel writers primarily are interested in that question. And then there's this kind of scaling out to Rome and Greek influence. What does this mean for the nations, specifically these nations now that we are assimilating into in some ways?
Yeah.
And then there's this sort of cosmic third horizon of the renewal of all things. And more.
Yeah, we are somewhere between... that second horizon and the third horizon. But I think one of the things that this model allows us to do is ask serious questions about our own place in the storyline. Christendom came, but it also went. Mm-hmm. It collapsed you sort of discussed the reasons why Christendom collapsed. Perhaps it was probably inevitable. It was perhaps a mark of the failure of a loss of integrity on the part of the church, or however we want to look at it. But we're dealing with a very different situation, the rise of a secular culture, a rational secular culture, is a massive challenge to the witness of a biblical people. And I think what this sort of model allows us to do then is to sort of narrate our own eschatology in that more immediate sense. So yeah, keep in view a final renewal of all things, because that gives us that fundamental confidence in the Creator God, who has called us to be his own people.
Hi everyone, my name is Megan Kamick, and I'm part of the producers group here at the Bible for Normal People. This podcast is brought to you by supporters on the Patreon platform. For as little as $1 per month, you can be part of the group that brings this podcast to normal people everywhere. Some things I appreciate about being part of the Patreon group is the supportive community, the fantastic book recommendations, and Pete and Jared answering all of my questions. Just kidding, I just develop more questions. If this free podcast has enriched your life in any way, Please consider supporting the hard work Pete and Jared put in to making this podcast something worth listening to at patreon.com/thebibleforNormalPeople. One group in particular we want to thank is our producers group, who truly helped the podcast improve and make it what it is today. Thanks to Jason Mann, Angela Smith, Rob Buckingham, Kendall Miller, Miles Dance, Lori Volkley, Marlon Wall, and Peter E. Watts. The Bible for Normal People couldn't happen without you. Now back to the podcast.
Is that less of a historical situatedness and more of a, I get the sense it's more of a moral situation.
What?
Like the destruction of all evil seems more, yeah. I'm not trying to locate myself and saying kind of the Left Behind series where I'm saying this is a code for that, but there's this more cosmic understanding that what I'm shooting for, what I'm as a Christian, I'm moving toward is justice, the renewal of all things, the destruction of evil, and the, you know, the victory of good. And that's a more of a moral charge than it is trying to locate these historical events in some way that now Jesus is going to vindicate these historical realities and usher in this new thing in that sense. Is that making sense?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I think all I would add to it is that it's more than moral, because at the heart of that new creation is that God dwells with his people and wipes away every tear from their eyes, and there's no more suffering and no more sin and everything else. But it's certainly not that sort of fantasy thing that we sometimes mm-hmm. get from these various apocalyptic schemas that are put out there. I think the details, the apocalyptic details that we get from Jesus, or we get from Paul, or we get from Revelation, had relevance seen from their own historical perspective, and you can sort of see that, and you can sort of tease these sort of details apart and work out, well, why they have been drawn from Scripture and what sort of story they are telling from the perspective of Jesus and his disciples in Judea, or from the perspective of Paul and the churches in Asia Minor and Greece, or, you know, they have a relevance then. It's when you sort of lump them all together and try and sort of throw them into an indeterminate future from our point of view. The language just doesn't work that way.
So I have a practical question about how we read the Bible moving forward. So just to summarize, when Jesus is talking about the future, largely he's talking about the immediate context of what's going to happen in 70 AD, or kind of the culmination of this tension between the Jewish people and the Romans. And so that's what Jesus is talking about. He's not talking about the 20th century. And then in this second horizon, it's situated in this Rome and Greece context, so it finds its fulfillment, if you want to say it that way, in that context. So how do we today, who aren't in that 70 AD situation, we're not living in a tension between Rome and the Jewish people, we're not living in a Rome and a Greek state, how do we now make meaning out of these texts? What is it? How do we read those?
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, this is the obvious criticism, that if you take this approach, then you're saying, the Bible has nothing to say to us because it spoke into these ancient periods. My sense is that if we tell our story well, then we will understand how we deal with the present. I mean, Tom Wright has that sort of well-known analogy of a Shakespearean play, a five-act play. And in the first four acts, plus a little bit more, you've got the biblical narrative, and the church is now a group of Shakespearean actors who have to work out where the story goes next. They are faithful to the first four acts. They know the mind of the playwright, and they are entrusted with acting it out. So there's an element of creativity in that. I think that sort of hermeneutic works. I think it. I've sort of written about this. I've blogged about this. I mean, I think I would make this. It's much more like the three-part Shakespearean histories. The problem with Wright's approach is it has very little to say about the last 1800, 2000 years of church history, and nothing to say about, well, what are we facing next? How do we tell a story about a people of God that has gone through all that whole of the Old Testament experience through this New Testament experience that is projected into the the future of the early church? And that we had 1500 years of Christian dominance in Europe that, that spread around the globe that has come to an end. How do we tell that story? How do we tell a story that makes sense of being a marginalized religious community in, you know, in the UK, in Europe, which is very secular in places, and increasingly in the US? I mean, this is simply looking at it from our very Western perspective, but I think, you know, this is what we need to learn to do. Tell the story and let the telling of the story tell us how to live what we're here for. I mean, the heart of this, the heart of the whole thing, is the fact that God called a people, the Creator God, the God who created all things good, has called a people to be, a priestly people, a servant people, an embodiment of new creation. And then the story is, well, how is this held together throughout history? And what we see, there are sort of moments of crisis in the Old Testament that are survived. We don't go back and live the Exodus again. We don't go back and live the exile again, though we may critically and intelligently say some of the things that the church has experienced are like those, but we're not going back and living them again. And I would read the New Testament in somewhat the same way. Mm-hmm. It's an experience, a moment in the history of this people that has radically transformed it and shaped it and made it what it is. In simple terms, Jesus has been given to it as Lord. He has saved it from that sort of final destruction of AD 70 because of the sin, the persistent sin of the people, and establish a new covenant. And these are the basic definition of what the church is. Now we are living with that, and the Christendom church had to work out as best it could how to do that under the particular political circumstances that presented to it. We have to work out what it means under very different circumstances.
Yeah, so in a way, I do see these connections you're drawing between Old and New Testament, because, you know, in Second Temple Judaism, before, you know, the 200-400 years before the coming of Christ, Jews were already having to think on their feet, you know, for how to make this story, their ancient narrative, how to connect it today. And in a way, the New Testament does function in a similar way, because once you get out into maybe even the late first century, you know, the Gospel of John and things like that, you've got people talking differently than you might see in other places of the New Testament, because we're living in a time that is not the same culture, the same way of thinking. You know, you mentioned Greco-Roman philosophy. You know, that's there in the New Testament, but it's, you have this Judaism thing too to deal with right before AD 70. And people are trying to, I'm just making sure I'm hearing you right, Andrew. People are, they've always had to try to figure out how does this story continue, paying attention to where the story's been, but not thinking that that is going to define our present moment, which is hard for some. I mean, I think that's fascinating, but I'm thinking too of people who might like freak out a little bit at the thought of Jesus, like you said before, what Jesus said had little to do with anything after the destruction of the temple by the Romans in AD 70, which brought judgment on the people of Israel. You know, if that's Jesus's focus, which makes a lot of sense, like the Olivet Discourse in the Gospels, which, you know, I grew up thinking that's a prediction of, you know, 1948 or something like that. But it's like, it's pretty obvious they're talking about the temple, and it's pretty obvious they're talking about AD 70 at this point. And that seems to be like a culminating moment for Jesus's teachings. Like this is a big deal. This is all saved towards the end of the Gospel stories. And, you know, we're really reframing what New Testament teaching is about the future here. That's really what we're doing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this in terms of sort of what we do with it, what you see happening in the New Testament, as I see it, is, and you're sort of talking about the way the Jews are doing this, the way you sort of make sense of new circumstances very often is by going back and taking old stories and retelling them. And when you retell the story, you can't always tell it exactly in exactly the same way. It might have to be adapted somewhat to the new context. But I think Jesus does this all the time. So much of the, not all the stories, but so many of the stories that he tells, the imagery that he uses is drawn from the prophets, drawn from the Psalms, and retold, reused to help his disciples in particular, but also others that he engaged with, to understand this new thing that was happening. And one of the key ones there is Daniel's vision of a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. I presume Jesus understood that Daniel was not talking about something that would happen in the first century AD. That passage, that section of Daniel, has reference to a crisis in the early second century BC, the whole business with the sort of Hellenization and Antiochus Epiphanes, and the way that threatened the existence of Israel. It was an existential crisis for God's people.
Yeah, that's the early second century BC, where Jews were threatened by forced conversion, so to speak, or for adopting Greek customs, and
yes,
Hanukkah comes out of that, and all that sort of stuff. So
yeah, that's the whole thing. The interesting thing is, it divided the Jews. So I mean, there are progressives amongst the Jews, right, who actually are quite keen to adopt Greek ways because this was modern, it was the future. Why cling to our out of date, antiquated religious past when we have this wonderful new culture offered to us? Antiochus Epiphanes then sort of went set about imposing it by force, and the visions of Daniel 7-12 emerge from that crisis, from that conflict, and they are given in support of that loyal community amongst the Jews, at least as I read it, that refused to abandon the covenant and suffered as a result. So there you've got what I think you've got in Daniel 7, in the Son of Man part of that, is a statement about the vindication of that section of Israel that is remains true to God under these sort of complicated new conditions. You know, the clash with the Greek world then becomes a clash with the Roman world, but the story still works, and Jews were using it. Josephus uses it to talk about this the situation under Rome. But you've got this image, this symbol emerges out of that, of the vindication of a faithful suffering community, which is, you know, not just vindicated but given a kingdom and dominion and glory and everything else, and the nations serve that people. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, there's a number of ways that the other ways that is interpreted, but that's sort of what it comes down to from my point of view, as best I can understand it. And the extraordinary thing that Jesus does is to identify himself with that faithful community. So this story he is now retold, but he makes himself that Son of Man figure. You know, it's partly about his faithfulness and his suffering and his vindication. But, you know, as you see, when he talks in those terms, he also involves his disciples with them. So, you know, if anyone would follow me, he would take up his cross as well.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Because it's not just, this is the historical sort of part to this. Jesus goes ahead. He's the forerunner. He's the pioneer. He's the one who opens up this narrow road, narrow path leading to life. But if others don't follow him down it, if other Jews don't follow him down it with the same message and the same conviction and if, you know, sooner or later, the same experience of the Holy Spirit. If they don't follow him down that and being prepared to take up their own cross and to suffer as he suffered and to die as he died and be raised and vindicated and glorified as he was, then, you know, there's still no future. He needed followers. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean?
So in that way, it's not that Jesus is... there's not a distinctive about Jesus in that message as much as it is, you know, the following me is a participation in this community, similar to how he appropriates this text in Daniel about a community.
I listened to the podcast you did with Daniel Kirk, and I think he made the same point about a cruciform community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sort of a crucial part of the process. If you're going to, what's at stake is the future of a people. If the Jews rebel against the Romans and the Romans come back and crush them and destroy the temple, that's sort of the end of it, pretty much. At least from, you know, as far as they could tell from that point of view, that was a broad road leading to destruction, and many were on it. There needed to be a narrow road leading to life, mm-hmm. A community that had built into it the resources, the vision, the imagination, the trust that would enable it to become part of, or the kernel, the core of a new future for God's people, the beginning of something new.
So I want to look at going back to just how you identified how Jesus would have used the text, say, of Daniel and appropriated that from. So in some ways, are you advocating that the church needs to learn how to do this better, how to make new meaning? I think we've spent the last few hundred years, since we have historical criticism and these tools, a heavy emphasis on finding out what it meant back there, that we're a little anemic on how do we make new meaning. And we have, as an example, Jesus and a lot of the writers of the New Testament really doing that almost without any inhibition. I mean, just they do this all over the place, and we talk about that on the podcast.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, it's a good way of putting it. It's an extraordinarily creative moment in the history of God's people, the same way that the exile was an extraordinarily creative moment, both before and after, and it was transformative. And I think Christendom was a creative moment. The church had to fashion, not from nothing, but it had to sort of create Christian society, dominant Christian society. That's all fallen apart in a big way. We're having to do it again. And so many of the conversations that are going on in the church at the moment are about how do we fashion a new imaginary for the church? How do we imagine a new future? It's not so different to what the church was doing 2,000 years ago, but the circumstances are massively different.
That's right, yeah, and it's hard to just simply go to the book, so to speak, and expect it to address those questions directly, I guess.
Two
questions. One is just, I'm going to go back a little bit because, I mean, some things are clicking for me here, and just to make sure that I get something. So when you go to Philippians, you know, every knee shall bow, every tongue confess. That is Paul's vision, let's say, for the future of this thing. He himself might not have been thinking of the conversion of the Roman world, or maybe he was. What do you think?
I think Paul was focused on the Greek and Roman world. I tend to think, you know, he sets out to travel from Jerusalem by way of Illyricum all the way to Spain, stopping at Rome on the way. I think that he's acting out. I think he's acting out his God, the God of Israel, the God of sort of oppressed, marginal Israel, annexing for himself the nations of the empire. I think he acts out, and I think Acts 17 is really important in this, is that thing that he talks about, which we always feel sort of awkward about because he doesn't proclaim the gospel there. But he does proclaim the gospel, and the gospel is precisely that the God of Israel is claiming this whole oikoumene, this empire, in effect, in Luke Acts, for himself. He's going to judge it. Those centuries of, he's overlooked their ignorance, their paganism for centuries, but no longer.
Right.
He's lost patience with them. They've run out of time, and he's now fixed a day on which he will judge this world by a man whom he has appointed. Now, right. You know, whether that's Paul or Luke or something between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it encapsulates very well the vision of an apostle sent from Jerusalem to claim the nations for the God of Israel.
Right.
In the name of Jesus.
And likewise, Acts 1, I mean, I'm thinking of Acts of, a common passage that supports missionary activity is the gospel going from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. But that's also, I mean, okay, here's my point. My point is that Philippians and Acts are oftentimes understood somewhat automatically as envisioning the way, way, way future.
Yeah.
Like, we're not there yet. But what you're saying is that those really have a more immediate horizon within, let's say, 300 years or so of when these things were being written.
Yeah.
Roughly, around the time, Roman Empire is converted. Whatever that means, not very well.
Perhaps, yeah, it's a process, and it's messy, and we're somewhat embarrassed by it now. But that's what happened. And if you'd gone back and asked people at the time, I'd put this argument to them, maybe it would have made a lot of sense.
Right.
It's just we look back on the failure of Christendom because we have bought into a whole package of Enlightenment values. That's a very different point of view.
Yeah. Okay. And actually, the second question I have is a lot more complicated. Feel free to give a quick answer if it's at all possible. If not, that's okay.
No, go ahead.
How does resurrection fit into this whole way of thinking?
Yeah. I mean, from my point of view, this was sort of the starting point in some ways of this line of thinking. We tend to think Jesus being resurrected ahead of a final resurrection of all the dead. So the resurrection that is described in Revelation 20 is anticipated in Jesus. Within that sort of Jewish perspective, I think it makes much more sense to say that actually what Jesus anticipates is the resurrection of faithful, suffering Israel in the context of the crisis. So you go back to Daniel 12, and you have a resurrection of those who are sleeping in the dust of the earth. Some of them, the righteous, the wise, those who turn many to righteousness, some of those are raised to life. Some are raised to disgrace and shame and so on. So you've got this sort of limited resurrection of a number of Jews as part of the deliverance and restoration of Israel at the moment of crime, presumably as part of that crisis involving the Greeks at the time. I guess that can be understood in different ways, but you see it elsewhere in Jewish writings as well, this hope that you see it in the Maccabean literature, the seven sons who are persecuted by Antiochus, express the hope that they will live again, even though he tortures and kills them. And it's I think what Jesus in the resurrection of Jesus anticipates is that more immediate, historically relevant vindication, resurrection of suffering faithful Israel, this is important for his disciples because they will face the same opposition that he faced. They will share in his suffering. They will be baptized into his death, and they will share in his vindication and glory and resurrection. The final resurrection of all the dead is another thing beyond that, and that then becomes about the whole of creation. But most of this, most of what's going on in the New Testament is more narrowly focused on the story of God's people facing the crisis of AD 70 and the crisis of Roman opposition in the coming centuries. Because if they had not had this conviction, when Jesus comes in a parousia, the sort of parousia that Paul describes in 1 Thessalonians 4, when he comes to be welcomed by his people, and I'm sort of thinking of this in sort of more or less symbolic terms, but when he comes as a sort of visiting king to parousia to be welcomed by his people, it's important that they had the certainty that people, that those who had lost their lives wouldn't miss out on this. So there's this assumption, this expectation that the faithful martyrs will be raised. And just one sort of final note there, that's what you see in Revelation 20, chapter 20. I think that's what this first resurrection of the martyrs, the souls seen under the altar, those beheaded because of for their belief in Jesus and the gospel. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's resurrection, that's the heart of resurrection. It's God vindicating his faithful servants who have lost their lives in this crisis for the sake of a new future for God's people. Where that leaves us is, you know, a little more complicated.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's theology.
That's theology. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Right.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time, and I kind of like that cliffhanger of where does that leave us? Mm-hmm. And that is the work of theology. So we want to thank you so much for coming on and just talking a lot of sense about these texts that can be really hard to understand, like Daniel and Revelation. But before we go, is there any place that people can find more of you and the work that you've done in this area or other areas? Where can people find you, either online or books that you've written?
Yeah, I blog on a fairly regular basis. It's postost.net. And it's basically this is what I blog. This line that this narrative historical approach makes sense of scripture, but it also gives us a good way of dealing with our own context and the extraordinary challenges that the church in the West at least faces today. I write a book called The Coming of the Son of Man some time back. Book on Romans called The Future of the People of God. And sort of forthcoming stuff that probably doesn't need to be mentioned just yet.
Okay. Excellent. Yes. Well, thank you so much.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you guys.
Thank you, Andrew.
Very much enjoyed it.
All right, folks. Well, thanks for listening to another episode. And we just want to remind you that we are reissuing a book that Jared and I wrote, what was it, in 2012?
12?
Yeah. Called Genesis for Normal People. That's our first publication together. And it's been sort of out of circulation, I guess, for various reasons, for maybe, I don't know, a couple of years.
Well, there's actually one reason. It's because we've been planning to reissue it for about 3 years now, and are we just now getting around
and
to it?
And stuff came up.
We started a podcast.
We stopped caring. All that kind of stuff. Anyway, it's finally happening, and it's the wild and wacky world of basically self-publishing. We sort of figured this out. So I should say Jared figured it out. I just sort of cheered him on from a great distance.
I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, that's great, Jared. You go do that.
Because we've had a lot of people who have gotten a lot out of that book. Genesis for Normal People is just a breakdown of kind of thinking about Genesis through ancient eyes, right, and breaking it down into simple categories and terms. And so we're excited to re-release that. We've had a lot of people who use it for small groups and other things. It's a good resource, so we're excited to get it back out there. So
It's out now. Go to Amazon, anywhere fine books are sold. You'll find it there.
That's it, folks. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.